my pleasure this morning to introduce our brother Johnny to be our speaker. He's taken the time to prepare a message for us, so let's give him our silent prayers and our kind attention as he brings us that message. Our brother Johnny.
Thank you, David. Thanks be to God for roses rare, for skies of blue and sunshine fair, for all the joy that now is mine. Thanks be to God. You know that I like to quote people who agree with me, and I don't know who I quoted. This was a song that we sang when I was in school, and that's all I remember of it. And I don't remember enough of the tune, I don't think, even to handle those few lines. But these few lines have come back to me over quite a number of years, many, many times, when I needed to be encouraged a little bit, and when I needed to stop and realize that there is a source of all good, and that it is God, and that to seek Him and to thank Him is the outline of life for us. And we were created as imperfect beings. We need to be reminded somewhat of the things that we know, that we have heard for sometimes many, many years, and to remember who is the source of all the good that occurs in the entire world. Just as much as we need to be reminded and take those reminders seriously, there's an enemy to our soul. And he would like to persuade us that we're the only one. And we will hear this from time to time among all sorts of people, that we are the one who decides what's right for us. And no one else can decide that. Not realizing that God decided before the creation what would be good for us, and that we've heard it ever since the creation, that we are not quite as important as the devil would encourage us to be, because we are not the inventor of what is right, or the one to decide what is wrong, and that's what he wants us to believe. And that all human fulfillment originates right in the human intellect and from no other source. And he had been able to sell that. It's a scam, isn't it? We hear lots about scams these days. And still, whenever one crops up, we hear somebody bid it. That somebody got cheated. That somebody got sold a bill of goods, that someone had to suffer because they believed that there is something for nothing. And I'm not going to bear heavily upon the theory of something for nothing, but that is what the devil is telling the people, that you don't have to serve God, that you don't have to serve anybody except yourself. Excuse me. I want to follow those comments with a part of a story that we know very well, that we've heard many times, that tells of a person who bought the scam who had known of God, but bought it because it sounded good, sounded easy, sounded attractive to him. And you'll remember his name. It was Corey Hoare. And his story is in chapter 16 of Alma. I'll try not to read over much of it, but it's because it's very lengthy. And I want to begin to read here at verse 40. No, it won't do at 40. I probably better just give you a little of the story of that rather than read that much. Because he had accused Alma and his fellow judges of keeping the people in bondage through the fear of the wrath of an imaginary God. And he had accused them, Alma and his brethren, of having robbed the ignorant people and made themselves rich. And where I was about to read there, Alma was defending them and saying, you know better than that. You know, you've been here long enough. You know that we have not taken 1 cent from this people. And we have not become rich. But he held forth and was pretty rigid about it and pretty brash. He would tell them, you're just kidding yourselves, that you're all this joy that you say that you have in your hearts about this God is baloney. And I'll begin to read verse 52. And now Corey Hoare said unto Alma, if thou wilt shew me a sign that I may be convinced that there is a God, yea, shew me that he hath power, and then will I be convinced of the truth of thy words. But Alma saith unto him, thou hast had signs enough. Will you tempt your God? Will you say, shew me a sign, when you have the testimony of all these, my brethren, and also all the holy prophets? He knew that Corior was schooled in what they knew, in what they had, because the books that they had were the books of the gospel. And he knew that he was acquainted with the prophets. And he continues then, verse 44, 54, I mean, the scriptures are laid before thee, yea, and all things denote that there is a God, yea, even the earth, and all things that are upon the face of it, yea, and its motion, yea, and all the planets which move in their regular form doth witness that there is a supreme creator. Yet do ye go about leading away the hearts of this people. Do ye go about leading away the hearts of this people, testifying to them that there is no God, and yet will ye deny against all these witnesses? And he said, yea, I will deny, except thou shew me a sign. These signs that Alma had mentioned to him were the things that I was thinking of when I remembered these words of the song, for all the joy that now is mine. When we look around us, we look at this comfortable building, we look out the windows, what do we see that is not what it is by the grace of God? The only time we see something that's not the grace of God is when we're forced to observe something that is the invention of the devil, something that in itself is evil, and something for us to stay away from. But he said, I won't believe just because you see the planets going around in order. And it might surprise us somewhat to hear Alma mention that. But they men started to watching the heavens very closely very early in their history. And they observed that what we see when we just look up at the sky and we see a myriad stars, they picked out the ones of those that reappeared in regular form and that seemed to move about among the other stars while the other stars stayed put. And they named them, and they studied their orbits, and they, the Greeks and the Romans in particular, created great myths of them and worshiped them and designed idols that they worshiped in the name of these various planets and stars. So it shouldn't be surprising to us that Alma knew all that. And I'll read on at verse 57. And now it came to pass that Alma said unto him, Behold, I am grieved because of the hardness of your heart. Yea, that ye will still resist the spirit of the truth, that thy soul may be destroyed. But behold, it is better that thy soul should be lost than that thou shouldst be the means of bringing many souls down to destruction by thy lying and by thy flattering words. Therefore, if thou shalt deny again, behold, God shall smite thee, that thou shalt become dumb, that thou shalt never open thy mouth any more, that thou shalt not deceive this people any more. Now Corihor said unto him, I do not deny the existence of a God, but I do not believe that there is a God. See how he's trying to take the middle of the road now? The sincerity and obvious truth of what Alma tells him is taking a hold a little bit, I believe. And he wants to not be quite so strong in his denial, but still hang on to it. I do not deny the existence of a God, but I do not believe that there is a God. And I say also that ye do not know that there is a God. And except ye shew me a sign, I will not believe. Now Alma saith unto him, This will I give thee for a sign, that thou shalt be struck dumb, according to my words. And I say that in the name of God, that ye shall be struck dumb, and that ye shall no more have utterance. And when Alma said these words, Corihor was struck dumb, that he could not have utterance according to the words of Alma. And we would also infer that when he was struck dumb, he was struck deaf, because of what we read in the next verse. And now when the chief judge saw this, he put forth his hand and wrote unto Corihor, saying, Art thou convinced of the power of God, in whom did ye desire that Alma should shew forth a sign? Would ye that he should afflict others to shew unto thee a sign? Behold, he has shewed unto you a sign, and now will ye dispute more? And Corihor put forth his hand and wrote, saying, I know that I am dumb, for I cannot speak. And I know that nothing, save it were the power of God, could bring this upon me. And I also knew that there was a God. But behold, the devil hath deceived me. For he appeared unto me in the form of an angel and said unto me, Go and reclaim this people, for they have all gone astray after an unknown God. And he saith unto me, There is no God. Yea, and he taught me that which I should say. And I have taught his words, and taught them because they were pleasing unto the carnal mind. And I taught them even until I had much success, insomuch that I verily believed that they were true. And for this cause I withstood the truth, even until I have brought this great curse upon me. Then he requested that his speech be returned to him, and Alma said, "No, this is the act of God upon you, and if you were permitted to speak again, you'd go back to your old ways." So here we have a man who was expert in all the ways of men, and persuasive, and educated, and smooth, had led away many of the people among whom he lived. And for the most part, it goes ahead and tells us that they returned to God, because they saw the power of God as it was executed against this man. We might also, if we read on into the next page, where he came to an inglorious end, that when the circumstances of a man's life force him, against his will, to believe and acknowledge God, that as a rule, it's too late. I think we must suppose that God can and sometimes does make exceptions to what is the rule among men. But as the general rule, I believe that we should not for a moment expect that a man can just go through life saying, "Well, I'm the exception to all the rules, and that God will bend the rules for me," because if we do that, I'm very certain that that entire philosophy will fail. Solomon in the Proverbs wrote in chapter 29, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." It's only a fraction of a verse. And I suppose that most of us have commonly defined that vision as prophecy or revelation, and say the people perish spiritually when these gifts are withdrawn. And I'm satisfied that that's good enough a definition for the term, but that it's narrower than it has to be. Because in my thinking, we should also call vision the discernment that's granted by God as a result of a person being well-meaning and diligent to do good and humble, and because of that, be able simply to see life as it really is. Because life is an imaginary thing to the majority of people. More people are playing a game with themselves than there are who look squarely at events and look squarely at themselves and think and act accordingly. And if we believe that he meant to include that, why, I believe that it also can broaden our appreciation for God's hand in our lives, in every incident of our lives, and that we would then behave wisely because of it. I have an expression of thanks for this type of understanding. And this I have read to you sometime in the past. I'm pretty sure it's getting so dim on the page from my notebook that it's kind of hard to get through. But this is from the writings of Robert Louis Stevenson. We remember a lot Robert Louis Stevenson for Kidnapped, I think, and Treasure Island and that sort of thing. He had a serious side too. "We thank thee," he said, "for the hope with which we expect the morrow, for the health, the work, the food and bright skies. Did you notice that he said, we thank the Lord for work? While he extols the providence of God here, he's thankful for work. And you see the bumper stickers that say a bad day fishing is better than a good day at work. And I remember a number of years ago when Teddy Kennedy was making his pitch for office to a group of union members, and one of them said, Teddy, is it true that you've never worked a day in your life? And he stumbled around a little bit and admitted that he hadn't. And the guy said, well, you haven't missed anything. Well, he had missed something. He had missed much of the satisfaction that an able man can gain in life. Because being able to do something that actually returns a good to mankind, beyond the fact that it brings us a paycheck, certainly does and should, certainly should generate for us some satisfaction and pleasure and some thanks. For the health, the work, the food and bright skies, for our friends in all parts of the earth, give us strength to encounter that which is to come, that we may be brave in peril, temperate in wrath, and down to the gates of death, loyal and loving one to another. We know that also this man that he was facing an untimely death because he was unhealthy when he was born and he never got over it. So he would have these thoughtful times and be thankful to God, even for at times the trials, because if we're thankful that God has given us trials and means to survive those trials and to appreciate that, we have seen more deeply into life than what is common among men. When Jacob, the brother of Nephi, was preaching to the Nephites, he spoke of the providence of God and the providence of God to all that seek him, not just a favored few, but to everyone who looks to God. And this is in chapter 5 of 2 Nephi. Page 102. And I want to read beginning at verse 70. You'll hear the question, the quotes on this, because they're there, and you know that you've heard it before. And we may not remember exactly where we heard it, but it's Isaiah chapter 51. Hearken unto me, ye that follow after righteousness. Look unto the rock from whence ye are hewn, and to the hole of the pit from whence ye are digged. He's telling us you came from not a whole lot. After all, you're made out of dirt. Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah, she that bare you, for I called him alone and blessed him. And of course, he was speaking to Israel, and Jacob was speaking to Israel. And as we read throughout the scriptures, we're promised all the promises that God made to those whom he loved. If we will be obedient to him, that we become heirs to the entire promise. Nothing left out. Full brethren to those whom God loved the most. Look unto Abraham, your father, and unto Sarah, she that bare you, for I called him alone and blessed him. For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. Hearken unto me, my people. Give ear unto me, O my nation. It's appropriate words for anybody in any walk of life, that they might admonish any who they can inspire or influence, even including their entire nation. Hearken to the Lord and give thanks. I also think that we're moved often as we read the Psalms, moved by the delight that David took in the providence of God. For God was very kind to David, and he writes so many of his Psalms dedicated to thanksgiving to God. And I want to read number 9 to you. It's short. I want to read the entire Psalm. Didn't look quite right because I was in Proverbs. I will praise thee, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will show forth all thy marvelous works. I will be glad and rejoice in thee. I will sing praise to thy name, O thou most high. When mine enemies are turned back, they shall fall and perish at thy presence. For thou hast maintained my right and my cause. Thou sattest in the throne, judging right. Thou hast rebuked the heathen. Thou hast destroyed the wicked. Thou hast put out their name forever and ever. O thou enemy, destructions are come to a perpetual end, and thou hast destroyed cities. Their memorial is perished with them. But the Lord shall endure forever. He hath prepared his throne for judgment. You notice he addressed himself in verse 6. To his enemy, the devil, and what evil he had brought about and destroyed nations. But in 7, I'll read again. But the Lord shall endure forever, for he hath prepared his throne for judgment. And he shall judge the world in righteousness. He shall minister judgment to the people in righteousness. The Lord also will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. And they that know thy name will put their trust in thee, for thou, Lord, hast not forsaken them that seek thee. Sing praises to the Lord which dwelleth in Zion, and declare among the people his doings. When he maketh inquisition for blood, he remembereth them. He forgetteth not the cry of the humble. And I don't believe I'll read the rest of it for you, but urge you to read it for yourselves at any time you'd like to, because it sets the pace of praise to God, and sets the mind to thinking of all the things he does for us. And whether we see our enemies or not on this earth, we have them, and we have that one most dedicated enemy of all, who is involved in our life continually, and that just doesn't give up. And also in Psalm number 8, he was speaking along the same line, verse 3 of it. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, just as Elma called the attention of this evil man whose name has already run away from me. Don't know why I let things like that get away, Corey Hoare. Alma was explaining to him the heavens, the work of the Lord's fingers. And the psalmist goes on, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? And most of the churches in the world don't admit that God knows your name, that he knows what you need before you can pray. And then Jesus in his ministry urged us that we go ahead and pray the things that are on our hearts and offer them before God and confess our lack and our need, even though we know that he does know all of those things. As I carried this a little farther with myself, and looking out my window and seeing the fertile land and the comfort that most people live in, and how we get here on Sunday in a comfortable car. We don't have to live out in the weather. We don't have to walk. We don't have a long time that we're involved in just getting to church. The natural resources that made all of this possible, all in the plan of God long before he began the creation. And to dwell upon that and consider how truly marvelous it is, can take a good deal of what might otherwise have been idle time for us, and to provide us the reassurance that we need from time to time. Even the good jobs that many of us work, not everybody can have a job that he likes. I was fortunate enough that I did. And there were times when I took any job I could get and gained satisfaction from being able to do them, because it was doing something for me and for something for those that I was responsible for. And so it was a source of peace and comfort. According to Henry Lee, without work, we're terribly diminished. Without being able to provide something for the world that we live in, something that's necessary in life as part of the product of this nation. That doesn't leave anybody out. If they're employed, their employment is intended to do something for humanity. Sometimes we scratch our heads and say, what is it? But God knows. And we have also worked with those who did their best to contribute nothing at all to humanity. And I believe that they were the most frustrated and the unhappiest people that I ever knew. The original inhabitants of this nation, of this continent. Remember that we are told in the Book of Mormon that the Lord had kept it empty and reserved it as a special place for those who earned the favor of God. And the first ones that came here, their story is rather involved, but 8 little ships containing not very many people. Doubtless a few tools and some seed and a few head of livestock. And when they came, we won't find anybody who was more grateful than they were. And we'll read just a few verses here in the book of Ether concerning them. This is going to be in chapter 3 of Ether. And it's page 727. Verse 13 tells of the way they were propelled. And thus they were driven forth 344 days upon the water. And they did land upon the shore of the promised land. And when they had set their feet upon the shores of the promised land, they bowed themselves down upon the face of the land, and did humble themselves before the Lord, and did shed tears of joy before the Lord because of the multitude of his tender blessings, his tender mercies over them. They knew the source of all that was good to them, all the hope that they had had from the days when the languages were confused at the Tower of Babel. Until this time, they had looked forward to the promise of God, of a land of promise, and they knew that they were there. Hadn't had a chance to till the ground, hadn't had a chance to explore the land, excuse me, but they knew that they were there. And a couple of the details that make this all the more marvelous to me, and I suppose that it makes it less believable to the skeptic. Those eight little boats, they couldn't see out of. They apparently had no sails, no rudders, nothing to fasten them together and hold them in a group. And after 344 days being propelled by what it called a furious wind, they all landed at the same time, at the same place. And that at a good place to land. We aren't sure when we come up to the American continent that it's going to be a place that we can land. But all of that, they received. It's just downright incredible. It's physically impossible, but not to God. And God brought them there together by his hand, all at the same time. And all I can say is when I think that through is wow. And then I think that the only real alternative to believing what this tells us about these people and about the other people that I have read about today and that we have read about and heard about at other times is that it's either believe that or suppose that you and I and the lowly maggot all by some quirk of fate developed from the very self-same genome, from the same source of life that widespread all animal life and perhaps all plant life. I don't know how they sort that out, but we read from time to time of plants that are fertilized and perpetuated because of a bee or a creature of some sort that lives where they live. And we want to ask ourselves, well, which came first then if it were a product of evolution? Surely if they came at the same time, How did they become dependent on each other? Doesn't make sense, does it? Well, it's not intended to. The Lord leaves those people to their own devices, and they bog down and don't make sense of nearly all that they said. But when we boil it down to that choice and think it through in that way, the only thing left for us to do is to bow ourselves down like these people did and humble ourselves before the Lord. And as my little 10th grade English teacher, who was not nearly as tall as I was then, was very fond of saying, and she said it reverently, "Thank the Lord for the difference."